Although I sold a couple of stories as a college student, my career as a professional fiction writer actually began just after my graduation. I had written a column, King's Garbage Truck it was called, the editor-in-chief's name for it, not mine, in the college paper for 2 or 3 years, and I stopped into the offices to pick up some of my junk 2 or 3 days after commencement. The place was totally empty, the first time I'd ever seen it that way. For a week or so, I'd had a story idea knocking around in my head, something about giant rats living and breeding under a New England textile mill. It wasn't a bit like the sensitive literary fiction I'd been doing in the creative writing seminars I had taken, not much like the slap-happy, sarcastic columns I'd written for the Garbage Truck, but that big, empty office and all those empty typewriters suggested a liberation and an openness I'd only guessed at during my last couple of semesters. They suggested I could do what I wanted. Wasn't school out? I spent that day knocking out a story called Graveyard Shift. I remember being very happy and very absorbed, having the time of my life, in fact. The story was gruesome, fast, and fun. It later became a film, which was gruesome and fast, but unfortunately, not much fun. I sent it out to Cavalier magazine, pretty much as it was. I might have put it through one fast rewrite, although I don't remember doing so. My writer's market said Cavalier would read unagented horror and science fiction stories, and that was good enough for me. It turned out to be good enough for Nye Wilden, the fiction editor at Cavalier, too. He bought it for $200, which seemed an enormous amount of money to a young man who had spent most of his college years in 2 pairs of blue jeans and had on more than one occasion supped on cheery casserole, a dish I invented. It consisted of Cheerios and peanut butter fried in Wesson oil. Ever had any? No? Good for you. By the time the check for Graveyard Shift arrived, I was engaged to be married. My intended, Tabitha Spruce of Old Town, Maine, enjoyed my stories a good deal, as I enjoyed her work, mostly poetry at that time. I met her while we were working together at the Raymond Fogler Library at the University of Maine, but really got to know her in a series of poetry seminars and workshops. She read a story of mine called I Am the Doorway in the early fall of 1970, and said it was one of the best science fiction stories she'd ever read. I was flattered out of my socks, not to mention the rest of my apparel. That story also sold to Cavalier, and by the time it was published, we were married. By 1973, we had a couple of kids. All that flattering each other out of our socks had inevitable consequences. And my short story sales to the men's magazines had become crucial to our financial survival. I began our partnership as a laundry worker and progressed to teaching high school English. Neither was quite enough for a family of four, but with the extra $1,200 or so from short story sales, we were able to get by. It got to the point where, when one of the kids got an ear infection and we needed to buy antibiotics, Tabby would say, half joking and half not, "Hurry up, Steve, think of a monster." In the late fall or early winter of 1972, I had an idea for a short story about a girl with telekinetic, or psychokinetic if you prefer, powers. The idea had actually been kicking around in my head since high school when I read a Life magazine article about a case of poltergeist activity in a suburban home. Poltergeists are frisky or teasing spirits, ghosts if you want to call a spook. The activity in this house seemed, on closer examination, to have nothing to do with ghosts. There was a troubled teenage girl in the family. When she was home, objects, particularly religious objects, flew through the air. When she was away, things stayed where they belonged. The article hazarded the theory that much of the activity ascribed to ghosts is actually caused by kids, and that girls on the brink of puberty seem especially apt to tap into this wild talent. The idea seemed to be that there was a great force within them, accessible only at this time of life. I thought it would make a good story, maybe worth as much as $500, and started to write it, working in the laundry room of our little trailer. In those days, I couldn't get away from washing machines, it seemed, and typing the first draft single-spaced and with extra narrow margins, as I always did. Paper cost money, and we had none to waste on extra sheets for first drafts. Before I had completed two pages, ghosts of my own began to intrude, the ghosts of two girls, both dead, who eventually combined to become Carrie White. I will not call either by her true name here. They were unfortunates in life and do not deserve to be chewed over, even in such a humble introduction as this, in death. I will call one of them Tina White and the other Sandra Irving. Tina went to Durham Elementary School with me. This was a bucolic, four-room country school with perhaps 60 pupils in all. Tina was pudgy and quiet, so back road you could cry. There is a goat in every class, the kid who is always left without a chair in musical chairs, the one who always winds up wearing the kick me hard sign, the one who stands at the end of the pecking order. This was Tina. Not because she was stupid, she wasn't, and not because her family was peculiar, it was, but because she wore the same clothes to school every day. I can still see that outfit. I don't even need to close my eyes. There was the red hairband over the black and really quite beautiful hair. There was the white sleeveless blouse worn both summer and winter, clinging ever more tightly to the growing and quite heavy bosom, and there was the black skirt falling gracelessly to the lower part of the shin. After Christmas one year, Tina came in wearing an entirely new outfit. I can't remember that one, only how happy she was to be wearing it. I think she might have even been wearing nylons. And I can clearly remember how her hopeful vivacity changed, first into surprise, then into anger, and finally into dull acceptance, as the teasing and the insults and the sarcastic comments rained down on her. Instead of abating, the kids' rejection of Tina became even fiercer. I did not take part in this behavior, which can only be termed as hazing, but I did not speak against it. Hell, I was only 14 years old. It's hard to stand up when you're 14. Sandra Irving lived about a mile and a half from the little house where I grew up. There was no father in the picture, only her mother and a large German shepherd with the absurd name of Cheddar Cheese. Mrs. Irving hired me one day to help her move some furniture. I might have been 16 or so by then, and I was struck by the crucifix hanging in the living room over the Irving couch. If such a gigantic icon had fallen while the two of them were watching TV, the person it fell on would almost certainly have been killed. I had known that the Irvings were religious in some queer and fervent way that excluded our run-of-the-mill Methodist church, but until I saw that hideous, dominating Christo, the impaled figure on the cross running blood and freshets from hands and feet inside, eyes upturned in a grisly combination of agony and compassion, I never fully understood how religious or how strange. That religion was part of what kept kids away from Sandy. The smell of her, not dirt, but some strange powdery scent like sweet and cloying library dust, was also part of it. The fact that she suffered from epileptic seizures and wore strangely modest, old-fashioned clothes also played their parts. But, as with Tina, there was something else as well, something that broadcast, "Strange, not like us, keep away," on a wavelength only other kids can pick up. It is like a pirate radio station of the heart. I can no longer pick up on that wavelength, but I can remember it very well, as I can remember Tina's black skirt and relentlessly yellowing white sleeveless blouse. Neither girl, fortunately or unfortunately, had Carrie White's wild talent. Neither made it through high school, nor saw the age of 30. Tina committed suicide, hanging herself in her cellar. Sandy died during an epileptic seizure in the small apartment she had taken in the town where we had all gone to high school. These were the ghosts which kept trying to come between me and what I was writing, kept insisting that I combine them somehow into a story that would tell what could have happened if there really was such a thing as telekinetic energy, and for all I know, there may be. What could have happened if the world was as fair to young girls as it is hard? In short, they wanted me to write a novel. I was frightened, both of the world of girls I would have to inhabit, it was a world I knew almost nothing about, and of the level of cruelty I would have to describe. I was also frightened to revisit what I'd not had the wit or moral courage to stop. And there was a more prosaic side as well. Tabby and I needed some quick money for groceries and rent, not a novel that might or might not sell to a publisher. I threw the half-completed first pages of the story into the wastebasket and went into the living room to watch TV. Tabby asked me what I'd been working on. I told her a short story, but it had gone bust and I'd thrown it away. Perhaps she saw something in my face, I don't know for sure. All I know is that she went into my little writing room, took the pages out of the wastebasket, shook off the cigarette ashes, smoothed them out, read them, and suggested I go on. I did, mostly to please her. The result turned out to be the short novel which follows, dated now, but still with a surprising power to hurt and horrify. It was published by Doubleday in 1974 and has remained in print ever since. Sometimes, quite often in fact, I wish that Tina and Sandy were alive to read it, or their daughters.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Carrie by Stephen King. Read by Sissy Spacek. With an introduction by Stephen King. Part 1. Bloodsport.
News item from the Westover, Maine Weekly Enterprise, August 19, 1966. Rain of stones reported. It was reliably reported by several persons that a rain of stones fell from a clear blue sky on Carlin Street in the town of Chamberlain on August 17th. The stones fell principally on the home of Mrs. Margaret White, damaging the roof extensively and ruining two gutters and a downspout valued at approximately $25. Mrs. White, a widow, lives with her 3-year-old daughter, Carrietta. Mrs. White could not be reached for comment. Nobody was really surprised when it happened. Not really. Not at the subconscious level, where savage things grow. On the surface, all the girls in the shower room were shocked, thrilled, ashamed, or simply glad that the white bitch had taken it in the mouth again. Some of them might also have claimed surprise, but of course their claim was untrue. Carrie had been going to school with some of them since the first grade, and this had been building since that time, building slowly and immutably, in accordance with all the laws that govern human nature, building with all the steadiness of a chain reaction approaching critical mass. What none of them knew, of course, was that Carrie White was telekinetic. Graffiti scratched on a desk of the Barker Street Grammar School in Chamberlain. Carrie White eats shit. The locker room was filled with shouts, echoes, and the subterranean sound of showers splashing on tile. The girls had been playing volleyball in period one, and their morning sweat was light and eager. Girls stretched and writhed under the hot water, squalling, flicking water, squirting white bars of soap from hand to hand. Carrie stood among them stolidly, a frog among swans. She was a chunky girl with pimples on her neck and back and buttocks, her wet hair completely without color. It rested against her face with dispirited sogginess, and she simply stood, head slightly bent, letting the water splat against her flesh and roll off. She looked the part of the sacrificial goat, the constant butt, believer in left-handed monkey wrenches, perpetual foul-up, and she was. She wished forlornly and constantly that you and I had individual and thus private showers, like the high schools at Westover or Lewiston. They stared. They always stared. Showers turning off one by one, girls stepping out, removing pastel bathing caps, toweling, spraying deodorant, checking the clock over the door. Bras were hooked. Underpants stepped in, too. Steam hung in the air. The place might have been an Egyptian bathhouse, except for the constant rumble of the jacuzzi whirlpool in the corner. Calls and catcalls rebounded, with all the snap and flicker of billiard balls after a hard break. "So Tommy said he hated it on me, and I'm going with my sister and her husband. He picks his nose, but so does she. So they're very shower after school and too cheap to spend a goddamn penny, so Cindy and I..." Miss Desjardins, their slim, non-breasted gym teacher, stepped in, craned her neck around briefly, and slapped her hands together once, smartly. "What are you waiting for, Carrie? Doom? Bell in 5 minutes." Her shorts were blinding white, her legs not too curved, but striking in their unobtrusive muscularity. A silver whistle, won in college archery competition, hung around her neck. The girls giggled, and Carrie looked up, her eyes slow and dazed from the heat and the steady pounding roar of the water. It was a strangely froggy sound, grotesquely apt, and the girls giggled again. Sue Snell had whipped a towel from her hair with the speed of a magician embarking on a wondrous feat and began to comb rapidly. Miss Desjardins made an irritated, cranking gesture at Carrie and stepped out. Carrie turned off the shower. It died in a drip and a gurgle. It wasn't until she stepped out that they all saw the blood running down her leg. From the shadow exploded, documented facts and specific conclusions derived from the case of Carrietta White by David R. Congress, Tulane University Press, 1981, page 34. It can hardly be disputed that failure to note specific instances of telekinesis during the White girl's earlier years must be attributed to the conclusion offered by White and Stearns in their paper, Telekinesis, A Wild Talent Revisited. That the ability to move objects by effort of the will alone comes to the fore only in moments of extreme personal stress. The talent is well hidden indeed. How else could it have remained submerged for centuries with only the tip of the iceberg showing above a sea of quackery? We have only skimpy hearsay evidence upon which to lay our foundation in this case, but even this is enough to indicate that a TK potential of immense magnitude existed within Carrie White. The great tragedy is that we are now all Monday morning quarterbacks. Period! The cat call came first from Chris Hargensen. It struck the tiled walls, rebounded, and struck again. Sue Snell gasped laughter from her nose and felt an odd, vexing mixture of hate, revulsion, exasperation, and pity. She just looked so dumb, standing there, not knowing what was going on. God, you think she never... Period! It was becoming a chant, an incantation. Someone in the background, perhaps Hargensen again, Sue couldn't tell in the jungle of echoes, was yelling, "Plug it up!" with hoarse, uninhibited abandon. Period! 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 Carrie stood dumbly in the center of a forming circle, water rolling from her skin in beads. She stood like a patient ox, aware that the joke was on her, as always, dumbly embarrassed but unsurprised. Sue felt welling disgust as the first dark drops of menstrual blood struck the tile in dime-sized drops. "For God's sakes, Carrie, you got your period," she cried. "Clean yourself up." She looked around bovinely. Her hair stuck to her cheeks in a curving helmet shape. There was a cluster of acne on one shoulder. At 16, the elusive stamp of hurt was already marked clearly in her eyes. "She thinks they're for lipstick," Ruth Gogan suddenly shouted with cryptic glee, and then burst into a shriek of laughter. Sue remembered the comment later and fitted it into a general picture, but now it was only another senseless sound in the confusion. 16, she was thinking. "She must know what's happening. She..." More droplets of blood. Carrie still blinked around at her classmates in slow bewilderment. Helen Shires turned around and made mock throwing up gestures. "You're bleeding," Sue yelled suddenly, furiously. "You're bleeding, you big dumb pudding." Carrie looked down at herself. She shrieked. The sound was very loud in the humid locker room. A tampon suddenly struck her in the chest and fell with a plop at her feet. A red flower stained the absorbent cotton and spread. Then the laughter, disgusted, contemptuous, horrified, seemed to rise and bloom into something jagged and ugly, and the girls were bombarding her with tampons and sanitary napkins, some from purses, some from the broken dispenser on the wall. They flew like snow, and the chant became, "Plug it up! Plug it up! Plug it up! Plug it!" Sue was throwing them too, throwing and chanting with the rest, not really sure what she was doing. A charm had occurred to her mind, and it glowed there like neon. "There's no harm in it, really. No harm in it, really. No harm." It was still flashing and glowing, reassuringly, when Carrie suddenly began to howl and back away, flailing her arms and grunting and gobbling. The girls stopped, realizing that fission and explosion had finally been reached. It was at this point, when looking back, that some of them would claim surprise. Yet there had been all these years of, "Let's short sheet Carrie's bed at Christian youth camp. And I found this love letter from Carrie to flash Bobby Pickett. Let's copy it and pass it around and hide her underpants somewhere and put this snake in her shoe and duck her again, duck her again." Carrie, tagging along stubbornly on biking trips, known one year as Puddin' and the next year as Truck Face, always smelling sweaty, not able to catch up, catching poison ivy from urinating in the bushes and everyone finding out, "Hey, Scratch Ash, your bum itch?" Billy Preston putting peanut butter in her hair that time she fell asleep in study hall. The pinches, the legs outstretched in school aisles to trip her up, the books knocked from her desk, the obscene postcard tucked into her purse. Carrie on the church picnic and kneeling down clumsily to pray, and the seam of her old madras skirt splitting along the zipper like the sound of a huge wind breakage. Carrie always missing the ball, even in kickball, falling on her face in modern dance during their sophomore year and chipping a tooth, running into the net during volleyball, wearing stockings that were always running or about to run, always showing sweat stains under the arms of her blouse, even the time Chris Hargensen called up after school from the Kelly Fruit Company downtown and ask her if she knew that pig poop was spelled C-A-R-R-I-E. Suddenly, all this and the critical mass was reached. The ultimate shit-on, gross-out, put-down, long-searched-for was found. Fission. She backed away, howling in the new silence, fat forearms crossing her face, a tampon stuck in the middle of her pubic hair. The girls watched her, their eyes shining solemnly. Carrie backed into the side of one of the four large shower compartments and slowly collapsed into a sitting position. Slow, helpless groans jerked out of her. Her eyes rolled with wet whiteness, like the eyes of a hog in the slaughtering pen. Sue said slowly, hesitantly, "I think this must be the first time she ever..." That was when the door pumped open with a flat and hurried bang, and Miss Desjardins burst in to see what the matter was. From the Shadow Exploded, page 41. Both medical and psychological writers on the subject are in agreement that Carrie White's exceptionally late and traumatic commencement of the menstrual cycle might well have provided the trigger for her latent talent. It seems incredible that, as late as 1979, Carrie knew nothing of the mature woman's monthly cycle. It is nearly as incredible to believe that the girl's mother would permit her daughter to reach the age of nearly 17 without consulting a gynecologist concerning the daughter's failure to menstruate. Yet the facts are incontrovertible. When Carrie White realized she was bleeding from the vaginal opening, she had no idea of what was taking place. She was innocent of the entire concept of menstruation. One of her surviving classmates, Ruth Gogan, tells of entering the girls' locker room at UN High School the year before the events we're concerned with and seeing Carrie using a tampon to blot her lipstick with. At that time, Miss Gogan said, "What the hell are you up to?" Miss White replied, "Isn't this right?" Miss Gogan then replied, "Sure, sure it is." Ruth Gogan let a number of her girlfriends in on this. She later told this interviewer she thought it was sort of cute. And if anyone tried in the future to inform Carrie of the true purpose of what she was using to make up with, she apparently dismissed the explanation as an attempt to pull her leg. This was a facet of her life that she had become exceedingly wary of. When the girls were gone to their period two classes and the bell had been silenced, several of them had slipped quietly out the back door before Miss Desjardins could begin to take names. Miss Desjardins employed the standard tactic for hysterics. She slapped Carrie smartly across the face. She hardly would have admitted the pleasure the act gave her, and she certainly would have denied that she regarded Carrie as a fat, whiny bag of lard. A first-year teacher, she still believed that she thought all children were good. Carrie looked up at her dumbly, face still contorted and working. "Get up," Miss Desjardins said dispassionately. "Get up and tend to yourself." "I'm bleeding to death," Carrie screamed, and one blind, searching hand came up and clutched Miss Desjardins' white shorts. It left a bloody handprint. The gym teacher's face contorted into a pucker of disgust, and she suddenly hurled Carrie, stumbling to her feet. "Get over there!" Carrie stood swaying between the showers and the wall, with its dime sanitary napkin dispenser, slumped over, breasts pointing at the floor, her arms dangling limply. She looked like an ape. Her eyes were shiny and blank. "Now," Miss Desjardins said with a hissing, deadly emphasis, "you take one of those napkins out. No, never mind the coin slot. It's broken anyway. Take one. Damn it, will you do it? You act as if you never had a period before." "Period," Carrie said. Her expression of complete unbelief was too genuine, too full of dumb and hopeless horror to be ignored or denied. A terrible and black foreknowledge grew in Rita Desjardins' mind. It was incredible. Could not be. She herself had begun menstruation shortly after her 11th birthday and had gone to the head of the stairs to yell down excitedly, "Hey, Mom, I'm on the rag!" "Carrie?" she said now. She advanced toward the girl. "Carrie." Carrie flinched away. At the same instant, a rack of softball bats in the corner fell over with a large, echoing bang. They rolled every which way, making Desjardins jump. "Carrie, is this your first period?" But now that the thought had been admitted, she hardly had to ask. The blood was dark and flowing with terrible heaviness. Both of Carrie's legs were smeared and splattered with it as though she had waded through a river of blood. "It hurts," Carrie groaned. "My stomach." "That passes," Miss Disjard said. Pity and self-shame met in her and mixed uneasily. "You have to stop the flow of blood. You..." There was a bright flash overhead, followed by a flash-gun-like pop as a light bulb sizzled and went out. Miss Disjardin cried out with surprise, and it occurred to her, the whole damn place is falling in, that this kind of thing always seemed to happen around Carrie when she was upset, as if bad luck dogged her every step. The thought was gone almost as quickly as it had come. She took one of the sanitary napkins from the broken dispenser and unwrapped it. "Look," she said, "like this." From The Shadow Exploded, page 54. Carrie White's mother, Margaret White, gave birth to her daughter on September 21, 1963, under circumstances which can only be termed bizarre. In fact, an overview of the Carrie White case leaves the careful student with one feeling ascendant over all others, that Carrie was the only issue of a family as odd as any that has ever been brought to popular attention. As noted earlier, Ralph White died in February of 1963 when a steel girder fell out of a carrying sling on a housing project job in Portland. Mrs. White continued to live alone in their suburban Chamberlain bungalow. Due to the White's near-fanatical, fundamentalist religious beliefs, Mrs. White had no friends to see her through her period of bereavement, and when her labor began 7 months later, she was alone. At approximately 1:30 p.m. on September 21st, the neighbors on Carlin Street began to hear screams from the White bungalow. The police, however, were not summoned to the scene until after 6 p.m. We are left with two unappetizing alternatives to explain this time lag. Either Mrs. White's neighbors on the street did not wish to become involved in a police investigation, or dislike for her had become so strong that they deliberately adopted a wait-and-see attitude. Mrs. Georgia McLaughlin, the only one of three remaining residents who were on the street at that time and who would talk to me, said that she did not call the police because she thought the screams had something to do with Holy Roland. When the police did arrive at 6:22 p.m., the screams had become irregular. Mrs. White was found in her bed upstairs, and the investigating officer, Thomas G. Merton, at first thought she had been the victim of an assault. The bed was drenched with blood, and a butcher knife lay on the floor. It was only then that he saw the baby, still partially wrapped in the placental membrane, at Mrs. White's breast. She had apparently cut the umbilical cord herself with the knife. It staggers both imagination and belief to advance the hypothesis that Mrs. Margaret White did not know she was pregnant or even understand what the word entails, and recent scholars such as J.W. Bankson and George Fielding have made a more reasonable case for the hypothesis that the concept, linked irrevocably in her mind with the sin of intercourse, had been blocked entirely from her mind. She may simply have refused to believe that such a thing could happen to her. We have records of at least three letters to a friend in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that seem to prove conclusively that Mrs. White believed, from her fifth month on, that she had a cancer of the womanly parts and would soon join her husband in heaven. When Miss Disjardin led Carrie up to the office 15 minutes later, the halls were mercifully empty. Classes droned onward behind closed doors. Carrie's shrieks had finally ended, but she had continued to weep with steady regularity. Disjardin had finally placed the napkin herself, cleaned the girl up with wet paper towels, and gotten her back into her plain cotton underpants. She tried twice to explain the commonplace reality of menstruation, but Carrie clapped her hands over her ears and continued to cry. Mr. Morton, the assistant principal, was out of his office in a flash when they entered. Billy DeLois and Henry Trennant, two boys waiting for the lecture due them for cutting French 1, goggled around from their chairs. "Come in," Mr. Morton said briskly. "Come right in." He glared over Desjardins' shoulder at the boys who were staring at the bloody handprint on her shorts. "What are you looking at?" "Blood," Henry said and smiled with a kind of vacuous surprise. "Two detention periods," Morton snapped. He glanced down at the bloody handprint and blinked. He closed the door behind them and began pawing through the top drawer of his filing cabinet for a school accident form. "Are you all right, Carrie?" Desjardins supplied. "Carrie White." Mr. Morton had finally located an accident form. There was a large coffee stain on it. "You won't need that, Mr. Morton." "Oh, I suppose it was a trampoline. We just..." "I won't?" "No, but I think Carrie should be allowed to go home for the rest of the day. She's had a rather frightening experience." Her eyes flashed a signal which he caught, but could not interpret. Okay, if you say so." "Good. Fine." Morton crumpled the form back into the filing cabinet, slammed it shut with his thumb in the drawer, and grunted. He whirled gracefully to the door, yanked it open, glared at Billy and Henry, and called, "Miss Fish, could we have a dismissal slip here, please? Carrie Wright." "White," said Miss Desjardins. "White," Morton agreed. Billy DeLoy sniggered. "Week's detention," Morton barked. A blood blister was forming under his thumbnail. Hurt like hell. Carrie's steady, monotonous weeping went on and on. Miss Fish brought the yellow dismissal slip, and Morton scrawled his initials on it with his silver pocket pencil, wincing at the pressure on his wounded thumb. "Do you need a ride, Cassie?" he asked. "We can call a cab if you need one." She shook her head. He noticed with distaste that a large bubble of green mucus had formed at one nostril. Morton looked over her head and at Miss Desjardins. "I'm sure she'll be all right," she said. "Carrie only has to go over to Carlin Street. The fresh air will do her good." Morton gave the girl the yellow slip. "You can go now, Cassie," he said magnanimously. "That's not my name," she screamed suddenly. Morton recoiled, and Miss Desjardins jumped as if struck from behind. The heavy ceramic ashtray on Morton's desk, it was Rodin's Thinker, with his head turned into a receptacle for cigarette butts, suddenly toppled to the rug as if to take cover from the force of her scream. Butts and flakes of Morton's pipe tobacco scattered on the pale green nylon rug. "Now listen," Morton said, trying to muster sternness. "I know you're upset, but that doesn't mean I'll stand for..." "Please," Miss Desjardins said quietly. Morton blinked at her and then nodded curtly. He tried to project the image of a lovable John Wayne figure while performing the disciplinary functions that were his main job as assistant principal, but did not succeed very well. The administration, usually represented at J.C. suppers, PTA functions, and American Legion award ceremonies by Principal Henry Grail, usually termed him Lovable Mort. The student body was more apt to call him that crazy ash jabber from the office. But as few students, such as Billy DeLoyce and Henry Trent, PTA functions or town meetings, the administration's view tended to carry the day. Now Lovable Mort, still secretly nursing his jammed thumb, smiled at Carrie and said, "Go along then if you like, Miss Wright. Or would you like to sit and just collect yourself?" "I'll go," she muttered and swiped her hair. She got up, then looked around at Miss Desjardins. Her eyes were wide open and dark with knowledge. "They laughed at me, threw things. They've always laughed." Desjardins could only look at her helplessly. Carrie left. For a moment there was silence. Morton and Desjardins watched her go. Then, with an awkward throat-clearing sound, Mr. Morton hunkered down carefully and began to sweep together the debris from the fallen ashtray. What was that all about? She sighed and looked at the drying maroon handprint on her shorts with distaste. She got her period, her first period, in the shower. Morton cleared his throat again, and his cheeks went pink. The sheet of paper he was sweeping with moved even faster. "Isn't she a bit, old for her first?" "Yes, that's what made it so traumatic for her. Although I can't understand why her mother..." The thought trailed off, forgotten for the moment. I don't think I handled it very well, Morty. But I didn't understand what was going on. She thought she was bleeding to death. He stared up sharply. I don't believe she knew there was such a thing as menstruation until half an hour ago. Hand me that little brush there, Mistress Jordan. Yes, that's it. She handed him a little brush with the legend, Chamberlain Hardware and Lumber Company Never Brushes You Off, written up the handle. He began to brush his pile of ashes onto the paper. Well, there's still going to be some for the vacuum cleaner, I guess. This deep pile is miserable. I thought I set that ashtray back on the desk further. Funny how things fall over. He bumped his head on the desk and sat up abruptly. It's hard for me to believe that a girl in this or any other high school could get through 3 years and still be alien to the fact of menstruation, Miss Disjardin. It's even more difficult for me, she said. But it's all I can think of to explain her reaction. And she's always been a group scapegoat. He funneled the ashes and butts into the wastebasket and dusted his hands. Oh, I've placed her, I think. White. Margaret White's daughter. Must be. That makes it a little easier to believe. He sat down behind his desk and smiled apologetically. There's so many of them. After 5 years or so, they all start to merge into one group face. You call boys by their brothers' names, that type of thing. It's hard. Of course it is. Wait till you've been in the game 20 years like me, he said morosely, looking down at his blood blister. You get kids that look familiar and find out you had their daddy the year you started teaching. Margaret White was before my time, for which I am profoundly grateful. She told Mrs. Besenti, God rest her, that the Lord was reserving a special burning seat in hell for her because she gave the kids an outline of Mr. Darwin's beliefs on evolution. She was suspended twice while she was here, once for beating a classmate with her purse. Legend has it that Margaret saw the classmate smoking a cigarette. Peculiar religious views. Very peculiar. His John Wayne expression suddenly snapped down. The other girls, did they really laugh at her? Sanitary napkins at her when I walked in, throwing them like peanuts. Oh dear. John Wayne disappeared. Mr. Morton went. That's not all of them, although some of them may rat on the rest. Christine Hargensen appeared to be the ringleader, as usual. Chris and her Mortimer snerds, Martin murmured. Yes, Tina Blake, Rachel Spies, Helen Shires, Donna Thibodeau and her sister Mary Lila Grace, Jessica Upshaw, and Sue Snell. She frowned. You wouldn't expect a trick like that from Sue. She's never seen the type for this kind of a stunt. Did you talk to the girls involved? Miss Disjardin chuckled unhappily. I got them the hell out of there. I was too flustered, and Carrie was having hysterics. He steepled his fingers. Do you plan to talk to them? Yes. But she sounded reluctant. Do I detect a note of... You probably do, she said glumly. I'm living in a glass house, see. I understand how those girls felt. The whole thing just made me want to take the girl and shake her. Maybe there's some kind of instinct about menstruation that makes women want to snarl. I don't know. I keep seeing Sue Snell and the way she looked. Mr. Martin repeated wisely. He did not understand women and had no urge at all to discuss menstruation. I'll talk to them tomorrow, she promised, rising. Rip them down one side and up the other. Good. Make the punishment suit the crime, and if you feel you have to send any of them to me, feel free. I will, she said kindly. By the way, a light blew out while I was trying to calm her down. It added the final touch. I'll send a janitor right down, he promised. And thanks for doing your best, Miss Disjardin. Will you have Miss Fish send in Billy and Henry? Certainly, she left. He leaned back and let the whole business slide out of his mind. When Billy Delois and Henry Trennant, class cutters extraordinaire, slunk in, he glowered at them happily and prepared to talk tough. As he often told Hank Grail, he ate class cutters for lunch. Graffiti scratched on a desk in Chamberlain Junior High School. Roses are red, violets are blue, sugar is sweet, but Carrie White eats shit. She walked down Ewan Avenue and crossed over to Carlin at the stoplight on the corner. Her head was down, and she was trying to think of nothing. Cramps came and went in great, gripping waves, making her slow down and speed up like a car with carburetor trouble. She stared at the sidewalk, quartz glittering in the cement, hopscotch grids scratched in ghostly rain-faded chalk, wads of gum stamped flat, pieces of tin foil and penny candy wrappers. They all hate and they never stop. They never get tired of it. A penny lodged in a crack. She kicked it. Imagine Chris Hargensen all bloody and screaming for mercy, with rats crawling all over her face. Good. Good. That would be good. A dog turd with a foot track in the middle of it. A roll of blackened caps that some kid had banged with a stone. Cigarette butts. Crash in her head with a rock. With a boulder. Crash in all their heads. Good. Good. Savior Jesus, meek and mild. That was good for Mama, all right for her. She didn't have to go among the wolves every day of every year, out into a carnival of laughers, joke-tellers, pointers, snickerers. And didn't Mama say there would be a day of judgment? The name of that star shall be Wormwood, and they shall be scourged with scorpions. And an angel with a sword? If only it would be today, and Jesus coming not with a lamb and a shepherd's crook, but with a boulder in each hand to crush the laughers and the snickerers, to root out the evil and destroy it, screaming, a terrible Jesus of blood and righteousness. And if only she could be his sword and his arm. She had tried to fit. She had defied Mama in 100 little ways. Had tried to erase the red plague circle that had been drawn around her from the first day she'd left the controlled environment of the small house on Carlin Street and had walked up to the Barker Street Grammar School with her Bible under her arm. She could still remember that day, the stairs, and the sudden, awful silence when she had gotten down on her knees before lunch in the school cafeteria. The laughter had begun on that day and had echoed up through the years. The red plague circle was like blood itself. You could scrub and scrub and scrub, and still it would be there, not erased, not clean. She had never gotten on her knees in a public place again, although she had not told Mama that. Still, the original memory remained, with her and with them. She had fought Mama tooth and nail over the Christian youth camp and had earned the money to go herself by taking in sewing. Mama told her darkly that it was sin, that it was Methodists and Baptists and Congregationalists, and that it was sin and backsliding. She forbade Carrie to swim at the camp. Yet, although she had swum and had laughed when they ducked her, until she couldn't get her breath anymore and they kept doing it, and she got panicky and began to scream, and had tried to take part in the camp's activities. 1,000 practical jokes had been played on old Praying Carrie, and she had come home on the bus a week early, her eyes red and socketed from weeping, to be picked up by Mama at the station, and Mama had told her grimly that she should treasure the memory of her scourging as proof that Mama knew that Mama was right, that the only hope of safety and salvation was inside the red circle. For straight is the gate, Mama had said grimly in the taxi, and at home she had sent Carrie to the closet for 6 hours. Mama had, of course, forbade her to shower with the other girls. Carrie had hidden her shower things in her school locker and had showered anyway, taking part in a naked ritual that was shameful and embarrassing to her, in hopes that the circle around her might fade a little, just a little. But today, oh, today. Tommy Erbter, age 5, was biking up the other side of the street. He was a small, intense-looking boy on a 20-inch Schwinn with bright red training wheels. He was humming Scooby-Doo, Where Are You? Under his breath. He saw Carrie, brightened, and stuck out his tongue. "Hey, old fart-face, old praying Carrie!" Carrie glared at him with sudden smoking rage. The bike wobbled on its training wheels and suddenly fell over. Tommy screamed. The bike was on top of him. Carrie smiled and walked on. The sound of Tommy's wails was sweet, jangling music in her ears. If only she could make something like that happen whenever she liked. Just did. She stopped dead, 7 houses up from her own, staring blankly at nothing. Behind her, Tommy was climbing tearfully back onto his bike, nursing a scraped knee. He yelled something at her, but she ignored it. She had been yelled at by experts. She had been thinking, "Fall off that bike, kid, push you off that bike and split your rotten head." And something had happened. Her mind had, she groped for a word, had flexed. That was not just right, but it was very close. There had been a curious mental bending, almost like an elbow curling a dumbbell. That wasn't exactly right either, but it was all she could think of. An elbow with no strength. A weak baby muscle. Flex. She suddenly stared fiercely at Mrs. Yorty's big picture window. She thought, "Stupid, frumpy old bitch, break that window." Nothing. Mrs. Yorty's picture window glittered serenely in the fresh 9 o'clock glow of morning. Another cramp gripped Carrie's belly, and she walked on. But the light. And the ashtray. Don't forget the ashtray. She looked back. "Old bitch hates my mama." Over her shoulder. Again it seemed that something flexed, but very weakly. The flow of her thoughts shuddered, as if there had been a sudden bubbling from a wellspring deeper inside. The picture window seemed to ripple. Nothing more. It could have been her eyes. Could have been. Her head began to feel tired and fuzzy, and it throbbed with the beginning of a headache. Her eyes were hot, as if she had just sat down and read the Book of Revelation straight through. She continued to walk down the street toward the small white house with the blue shutters. The familiar hate-love-dread feeling was churning inside her. Ivy had crawled up the west side of the bungalow. They always called it the bungalow because the White House sounded like a political joke, and Mama said all politicians were crooks and sinners and would eventually give the country over to the godless Reds, who would put all the believers of Jesus, even the Catholics, up against the wall. And the Ivy was picturesque. She knew it was. But sometimes she hated it. Sometimes, like now, the ivy looked like a grotesque giant hand ridged with great veins which had sprung up out of the ground to grip the building. She approached it with dragging feet. Of course, there had been the stones. She stopped again, blinking vapidly at the day. The stones. Mama never talked about that. Carrie didn't even know if her mama still remembered the day of the stones. It was surprising that she herself still remembered it. She had been a very little girl then. How old? 3? 4? There had been that girl in the white bathing suit, and then the stones came, and things had flown in the house. Here the memory was. Suddenly bright and clear, as if it had been there all along, just below the surface, waiting for a kind of mental puberty. Waiting, maybe, for today. From Carrie, The Black Dawn of TK, Esquire Magazine, September 12, 1980, by Jack Gaver. Estelle Horan has lived in the neat San Diego suburb of Parrish for 12 years. And outwardly, she is typical Ms. California. She wears bright print shifts and smoked amber sunglasses. Her hair is black streaked blonde. She drives a neat maroon Volkswagen Formula V with a smile decal on the gas cap and a green flag ecology sticker on the back window. Her husband is an executive at the parish branch of the Bank of America. Her son and daughter are certified members of the Southern California Sun and Fun crowd, burnished brown beach creatures. There's a hibachi in the small, beautifully kept backyard, and the door chimes play a tinkly phrase from the refrain of Hey Jude. But Ms. Horan still carries the thin, difficult soil of New England somewhere inside her. And when she talks of Carrie White, her face takes on an odd, pinched look that is more like Lovecraft out of Arkham than Kerouac out of Southern Cal. Of course she was strange, Estelle Horan tells me, lighting a second Virginia Slim a moment after stubbing out her first. The whole family was strange. Ralph was a construction worker, and people on the street said he carried a Bible and a .38 revolver to work with him every day. The Bible was for his coffee break and lunch. The .38 was in case he met Antichrist on the job. I can remember the Bible myself. The revolver? Who knows? He was a big olive-skinned man with his hair always shaved into a flat-top crew cut. He always looked mean, and you didn't meet his eyes. Not ever. They were so intense they actually seemed to glow. When you saw him coming, you crossed the street and you never stuck out your tongue at his back. Not ever. That's how spooky he was. She pauses, puffing clouds of cigarette smoke toward the pseudo-redwood beams that cross the ceiling. Stella Horan lived on Carlin Street until she was 20, commuting to day classes at Lewin Business College in Motton. But she remembers the incident of the stones very clearly. There are times, she says, when I wonder if I might have caused it. Their backyard was next to ours, and Mrs. White had put in a hedge, but it hadn't grown out yet. She'd called my mother dozens of times about the show I was putting on in my backyard. Well, my bathing suit was perfectly decent, prudish by today's standards, nothing but a plain old one-piece Janssen. Mrs. White used to go on and on about what a scandal it was for her baby. My mother, well, she tries to be polite, but her temper is so quick. I don't know what Margaret White said to finally push her over the edge. Call me the whore of Babylon, I suppose. But my mother told her our yard was our yard, and I'd go out and dance the hoochie-coochie buck naked if that was her pleasure and mine. She also told her that she was a dirty old woman with a can of worms for a mind. There was a lot more shouting, but that was the upshot of it. I wanted to stop sunbathing right then. I hate trouble. It upsets my stomach. But Mom, when she gets a case, she's a terror. She came home from Jordan Marsh with a little white bikini, told me I might as well get all the sun I could. After all, she said, the privacy of our own backyard and all. Stella Horan smiles a little at the memory and crushes out her cigarette. I tried to argue with her, tell her I didn't want any more trouble, didn't want to be a pawn in their back fence war. Didn't do a bit of good. Trying to stop my mom when she gets a bee in her head is like trying to stop a Mack truck going downhill with no brakes. Actually, there was more to it. I was scared of the Whites. Real religious nuts are nothing to fool with. Sure, Ralph White was dead, but what if Margaret still had that .38 around? But there I was on Saturday afternoon, spread out on a blanket in the backyard, covered with suntan lotion and listening to Top 40 on the radio. Oh, Mom hated that stuff, and usually she'd yell out at least twice for me to turn it down before she went nuts. But that day she turned it up twice herself. I started to feel like the whore of Babylon myself. But nobody came out of the White's place. Not even the old lady to hang her wash. No, that's something else. She never hung any undies on the back line. Not even Carrie's, and she was only 3 back then. Always in the house. I started to relax. I guess I was thinking Margaret must have taken Carrie to the park to worship God in the raw or something. Anyway, after a little while, I rolled on my back and put one arm over my eyes and dozed off. When I woke up, Carrie was standing next to me and looking down at my body. She breaks off